Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Sanjay Gamawat, ACM Infosys Foundation Award recipient in 2013, which is computing's top prize for young innovators. Sanjay is also a world-renowned researcher. Now, Sanjay, you have so many outstanding research contributions with tremendous, lasting, significant global impact, so thank you for sharing your considerable expertise and deep accumulated insights and wisdom with our audience.
That's very kind of you to say, Stephen. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Now, Sanjay, you know that this award is an extraordinary honor. It's one of the top prizes in computing. So when you heard about this award, you know, what was sort of the reaction of your colleagues? How did you feel at the time? And, you know, how about from your family?
I was initially very surprised. I know some of the past winners, and I feel honored to be associated with them. And I also feel very grateful, especially to my co-recipient, Jeff, who has been responsible for a lot of the hard work behind this award, and all of our colleagues who sort of wished us well and who have worked well with us over the years and helped us with all of the systems we have built. And my family was very excited, especially my parents, though I did have to explain to them the significance of the award.
You know, it's interesting. You know, it's this remarkable achievement. You're going to get global sort of recognition for it because it's one of the top prizes in computing. So how will the ACM Infosys Foundation Award impact your work, your influence, and your thinking into the future?
So I'm not a great person at predicting the future, so hard to tell what will happen. My biggest hope is that I will continue getting the chance that I've already had to work on great problems with great colleagues and hopefully more and more interesting problems in the future. So that's sort of the main hope and prediction I have.
Let's extend that question now in terms of, you know, what are your personal life or career goals that you want to achieve and how will you achieve them?
So I've always been very interested since I was pretty young in building things, taking them apart. And I guess computer science is a non-physical way of building things and hopefully not taking them apart too often. And I am really happy to have had a chance to do that for so many years. And I still enjoy doing it. And I hope I continue building systems, programming, working with Jeff, finding challenging things that require a lot of thought behind them to work on in the future.
Okay, we're now going to talk about your work that led to the ACM Infosys Foundation Award. And the first question is, how did your 2004 research paper on MapReduce solve the core computing challenges of scale and keeping up with the demand for a search service?
So the basic challenge we were facing was we were dealing with a large amount of data, many hundreds of terabytes of data often. And so you cannot process all of that serially in one computer in any reasonable amount of time. So we were always splitting the program up, the problem up into many, many small pieces, doing the pieces, handling the pieces in parallel in many machines, you know, then collecting the results from all of them, all of those machines. And this was very, sort of tedious and error prone, tedious because every single new problem that came up, you had to do the similar kind of breakdown of the problem into many pieces. So what MapReduce does is it takes all of the common pieces out of writing a program in such a way and kind of abstracts things away so that the programmer who's actually can focus on the bits of the problem that they're interested in, and MapReduce takes care of all of the mechanics of partitioning the data and having it be processed on thousands of computers in parallel.
You know, it's a fascinating piece of work. And then, so in what way can software solutions solve what seem to be hardware problems?
So one of the things that we had to focus on, especially in the MapReduce work, was, yes, we were first able to throw a lot of hardware at the problem, you know, use thousands of machines to deal with a big problem. But then hardware and software has a problem along the lines of, say, failures. Things will crash. Hard drives will crash sometimes. You know, computers will stop working. Software has problems. So what our higher level software does is it hides those problems from the programmer by managing failures internally. So one way you can do that is you can say the system itself is taking care of detecting when failures happen and automatically taking the work that was being done on the failed component or computer and doing it on another piece of hardware, which is hopefully working at the moment. So that's one example. There are other places where software can have a bigger role. For example, over the last 10 years or so, clock rates on CPUs have basically been stagnant. The number of cores have been increasing, but it's hard to take our existing serial programs and run them on those larger number of cores efficiently and easily, and I think that's where a lot of new software is needed to help make that transition better.
So then what are the underlying designs that hide the complexity of managing enormous clusters of computers from the programmers?
There are a few types of things that keep coming up in many systems which run on a large number of computers. So first of all, you have to be really careful and make sure that programmers do not have to worry about the location of the data or the location of a particular piece of data or which machine is going to run on which piece of the computation. Instead, what should happen is that the software system should provide an abstraction which hides that location, the details of that location, away from the programmer, and instead internally manages things like placing data on a disk with available space, running a piece of computation on a computer which is currently idle, etc. And this is very helpful, because once you provide this level of location independence, you can solve a whole bunch of other problems. For example, you can have this computer system automatically determine that this particular disk is going bad and make a copy of its data on another disk, which would be more disruptive to do if the location of the data was built into the higher levels of the system, because then they would have to be updated to deal with this internal failure handling process.
You know, one of the biggest sort of technologies that have been pervasive in government and in industry is this whole idea of cloud computing. And I guess it's been around for a while, but your work has really been fundamental in this explosion of cloud computing. So how has your work led to the advent of cloud computing, and where computing power is provided as a utility to consumers with all the hardware and implementation details abstracted away?
Well, first of all, I don't want to take responsibility for all of cloud computing. I think a lot of things have come together and which have made sort of, you know, now the right time for cloud computing to take off. But the places where our work, Jeff and my work, has contributed a fair bit is because our work has focused on providing practical access to large computing resources, such as large amounts of storage, large amounts of computation for dealing with very large data problems. And there has been a lot of pent-up demand for such systems. And I think cloud computing is a natural fit for some of these systems, because many people are unlikely to put a cluster of sort of 1,000 computers or more in their basement. And therefore, now that these techniques are available and easily understood by many people for how to run large computations, that combines with the fact that, different providers are providing these access to their clouds to a whole bunch of customers, and that sort of is combining to make cloud computing take off.
Now, in the prior questions, you talked about, or in your answers, I should say, you talked about these abstractions that are making it possible. Let's see if we can drill into that a little bit deeper. So how do these abstractions make it easy for programmers to take advantage of large-scale computational resources by automatically parallelizing computations across machines and then transparently handling failures?
So let me describe a scenario. So suppose you have a fairly simple program which is going to be given some input data and is going to search for some kind of pattern in it. And what we do is we give it, the input data is very large, many, many terabytes of data. So the programmer is going to find that, they can write a simple program and it'll run it over the data, but it'll be too slow if you run it on one machine. So the next step that the programmer will take is they will sort of take the pieces of data that are coming in, manually split them up into pieces, and then farm out the processing of all of these pieces to many machines, and therefore, hopefully, with enough machines, this computation will go faster. But some problems will start showing up. So, for example, suppose you have 1,000 machines, and I don't know how often your computer goes down. Let's say it goes down once a year. In the 1,000 machines, you'll expect about 3 of them to go down every year, every day. So as you're running this computation, chances are one of your computers will crash. And you don't want to throw away all of the work that has been done and start from scratch, because you will never get finished if your program is, if your problem is large enough. So then the next step that the programmer has to do is they have to write code which handles the failures by sort of periodically probing the machines, detecting which ones are not responding, finding the work they were doing, scheduling the execution of that work on another machine, and then sort of eventually collecting the results from each one of these machines. And also the result collection mechanism itself can be very slow, especially if your program produces a lot of results for each input item. So then you have to work on parallelizing the collection of the result as well. And this is sort of what MapReduce aims to automate, is all of the common parts of this workflow. So the programmer will say, here's a function, the map function. Please run this on every piece of the input data, and it'll produce some results. And here's another function, the reduce function. Please take all of the results of the map functions, partition them by some part of the result, a key of the result, and then apply this reduce function to merge everything with the same key. And that takes care of the result collection part. So the programmer provides these two functions, which are hopefully very simple if the problem is simple, and sort of proportionally complicated as the complexity of the problem that the programmer is focusing on goes up. And then the MapReduce system itself takes care of the other work, the common work across all such problems, which is partitioning the workout, collecting results, handling failures, managing I/O, etc.
Now, you've done a lot of work on file systems, so can you share the thinking behind a file system that allows huge files to be efficiently distributed across thousands of servers?
So the file system work started much before the MapReduce work, and it was motivated by some problems we were running into. The web search work has a gigantic data pre-processing step where you have fetched web copies of web pages from web servers all over the world. This is called the web crawl. And then you do various types of computation on this data to make it better for searching. You might reorganize it so the queries run efficiently. You might collect some data, extract some data from lots of pages so that the web search results are ranked better. And all of this computation takes a long time, and it has to be split across thousands of machines. And what was happening was that just managing the data that was being read and written by these pre-processing programs was a big pain. We were manually managing this data. For example, when a machine failed, we would find another copy of the data that was on that machine, start off a script to make a new copy of that data onto, a new machine, like a sort of a standby machine that we had lying around, restart all of the programs to point at the new location of the data, and then continue. So what GFS, the file system work that you mentioned, was designed to do was to automate this management and placement and management of data replicas. So we had a fairly simple design. What we said was, our batch processing systems for this data are basically had a fairly simple input-output pattern. They would take a large input file, run some computation over it, and produce some set of large output files. So we only had to really focus on dealing with large files that were just written once sequentially. So we designed our file system around that to take advantage of that so that we could keep it simple. We didn't have to deal with very random IO workloads. We didn't have to deal with billions of tiny files. And so we took some shortcuts. We said, let's take all of the metadata for all of the files, assume that's going to fit in one memory, in the memory of one machine, have that machine just manage the placement of all of the files on other machines.
Now, Sanjay, you already talked about some of the concepts behind MapReduce. Can you even drill even deeper about what are some of the underlying design concepts behind it?
So some of the concepts, the map and reduce function, go back to functional programming many, many decades ago. Those functions, similar functions, have been present in functional programming languages for a while. And people have explored using them for parallelism before. I think the connection machine in the mid-90s, early 90s, for example, would automatically take functions like map and run them across thousands of small, simple processors. So in some sense, the concepts are coming from there. The big thing I think we did, which was slightly different, is we also incorporated failure handling into this paradigm. And for that, we had to do a fair bit of work to make sure that the combination of map and reduce, which was our programming model, would run well on a large cluster of machines where things were going up and they're going down and coming back up very frequently.
You also worked on something called Big Table. Can you share the design concepts behind it?
Sure. So as I mentioned, our earlier file system work was focused around a relatively small number, say a million, large files, and we would manage the metadata of all of these files in one machine. Bigtable was motivated by places where this assumption fell down. So, for example, we wanted to store, again as part of web search, we wanted to store billions and billions of small, fine-grained pieces of information. So, for example, for every URL that we crawl, we might want to keep a list of all of the other URLs that we had found, which contain the link to the first URL. And this, as you can imagine, can be very useful when you're ranking web pages. But our file system didn't really handle such fine-grained data storage very well because, as I said, it was geared towards managing a small, relatively small number of large files. So the abstraction we came up with was, let's assume that the data model is a table, a big table, so to speak. It contains a large number of rows. The system will take this large number of rows, partition them into small, take the table with a large number of rows and partition it into a large number of pieces, which we call tablets. They're part of a table, so they're tablets. And then assign these tablets to different computers to manage. So now what we have taken is we have taken a large collection of very fine-grained pieces of data and spread them across a lot of machines and have the system take care of the management of sort of the read and write operations we want to support on these pieces of data.
So what is the impact of scale on otherwise easy problems?
So when you're writing a program and you're going to run it on a single machine or maybe a handful of machines, you can often just ignore failures and you can write fairly straightforward code. Most programmers can do this very easily. However, suppose your program is going to have to scale up to run on, say, 1,000 machines. Now, at some point, you can't ignore failures anymore just because they happen often enough in a large cluster of machines that your program will never finish if your strategy for dealing with failure is to restart everything from scratch when anything fails. So a similar problem occurs with, say, performance. So suppose you have a query coming into a web search system, and the way you're going to handle it is you're going to send a copy of a query to 1,000 machines. Each one is going to give you the results from the piece of the data it is managing, and then you're going to collect all of these results up and pick from these results and send the results back to the client. Now, what happens in most non-real-time, most computing systems people run, is they often have sort of unpredictable short delays here and there. So now consider this thing where you have spread out your query across 1,000 machines. Chances are that any given point in time, one of those machines is going to be slightly slow because it's doing some other background work. So now what happens is even though the average machine responds very fast, the slowest machine for any given query is going to be much slower. And so your total query handling time, as far as the client is concerned, is going to be pretty poor because it's going to be gated by the performance of the smallest machine. So this is again sort of scale biting you. If you were parallelizing your query handling across 10 machines, it would not be a big problem that one of them, 10 might be slow, say, once every hour or so. But if it's 1,000 machines, then about every minute something will be slow.
So how does your close relationship with real products influence your research decisions?
That's a great question. I think both Jeff and I, the systems that we've been working on, they're coming from a slightly different background than many of the systems that people have worked on previously, both in academia and industry. And the reason for that is that all of the systems that we have built, we have been motivated by problems that we had been personally running into while working on some other real product. So the research is a byproduct of what we were really trying to do. It is very, very helpful to kind of have some real concrete problem in front of you and know that the research will have a great impact in something. Maybe it'll make the programmer's life much easier. Maybe it'll make it very efficient to handle incoming queries. And this is the big challenge here is to make sure that the research you do, the systems you build to handle these problems, are not too focused on the immediate problem. You have to step back and abstract a little bit so that what you designed for this particular product or problem that you're running into is the design itself is more general and longer lasting than you need for just this product. And I think Jeff and I have been lucky and fairly successful with that.
You know, it's interesting. You talked about the sort of relationship between real products and your research. Can you name some of the products that you've influenced in what way?
So one of the key pieces of web search is the query serving system. This is basically the part of the system that runs when a user types in a query and it arrives at Google and it gets spread out across machines and the results get collected up. And we have rewritten this several times, the system, just because as things scale, you realize bottlenecks that were there in the older system, which you cannot live with anymore. Maybe you have some good idea of how you want to organize the data so it's more efficient to access. Or maybe there's some new types of data access you want to support to improve the quality of the results. So as we did all of these rewrites, I think, early 2000, we were doing one such rewrite and we found ourselves, Jeff and I found ourselves writing code which was very, very similar to code we had written before. And we started realizing that we were basically repeating ourselves and kind of wasting our time doing this, writing the same similar code over and over again. And that's what led to MapReduce. We kind of took a step back and say, well, what are the patterns between all of these programs that we are writing? And the result of that was the MapReduce programming model. We were able to formalize the common parts away so that the problem-specific parts could be extracted into simple map and reduce functions, and everything else could be written once and then reused for all of these other, for different combinations of map and reduce functions.
You've already touched on this already, but again, let's drill further. Why are failures the hard part of distributed systems?
So let's go back to MapReduce. So suppose you didn't have to worry about failures. You had a large fleet of computers and they were never going to fail. And you wanted to build something like MapReduce for that environment. Well, you could take MapReduce and replace it with a fairly simple library. You know, the library would have a little bit of logic to take the inputs, split it up into pieces, schedule them on the machines, process them in parallel, combine the results. You know, these techniques have been known for decades, and they're fairly simple, easy to implement when you need them. But since we can't really have this mythical world with no failures, what we have to do in the MapReduce implementation is figure out how to deal with failures. And so one critical thing you need to do is you need to have a bit more discipline about the programming model that you support. So, for example, if you have divided up the work into multiple pieces and there's piece A and you've started running on one machine, and you have piece B, which is running on another machine, you cannot have A's computation affect B's computation, because if you allow that in an unconstrained way, if you allow arbitrary communication between them, then what happens if the computation of A fails and you have to restart it? B's computation will now have been infected with partial results that A might have sent. So the programmer now will have to, if you allow such arbitrary communication, the programmer now has a much harder job of trying to figure out what happens when something fails and is restarted. And so this is one of the big benefits of applying the MapReduce programming model. MapReduce is a constraint on the programmer, right? It is not giving the programmer new functionality. What it's telling the programmer is, you limit yourself to programming in this limited form, and the system will take care of failures and parallelization and input-output handling for you. And the benefit of those constraints is that now you can deal with failures in a much simpler way. You run the piece of computation for A on one machine. You run B's computation on another machine. You don't allow them to communicate with each other directly. If one of them fails, you can restart it without having to worry about restarting other pieces of work. So, and then of course there are other mechanical things you need to add to MapReduce to deal with failures. You need to add a bit of code to make sure that it can figure out when something has failed by periodically sort of pinging all of the machines that are part of the computation. Once something has failed, it probably needs some mechanism to restart things from a checkpoint if there's one available. And, you know, all of these things add up, and they add a fair bit of complexity to a system like MapReduce. But part of the goal of MapReduce is to take on all of that complexity and at least remove that complexity from the programmers that are using MapReduce.
Your co-winner of the award is Jeff Dean. So what is your working style when the two of you collaborate?
Jeff and I have been working together for many years, since the mid-90s, I think. I love working with him. It is what we do is we typically sit at the same desk and program. One of us is typing, and maybe we'll switch that responsibility around every couple of days or so. As one person is typing, both of us are, we are discussing what we are doing. We are bouncing ideas that come to us. We argue the pros and cons of different approaches, spot mistakes that, you know, might be creeping in, just sort of having a separate, sanity check on what one person is thinking with very, very fast communication and back and forth.
What happens, though, if you have two sort of opposing points of view and they're kind of diametrically opposed? I mean, what do you do to resolve that?
Well, this happens quite a bit. I think people sitting near us will make jokes, you know, about us bickering about such things. And we do have arguments. We'll discuss pros and cons, but we know each other very well. We trust each other's judgment. So we, you know, argue it out until we, you know, one of us can convince the other. And if you can't, we decide at some point, we say, well, you know, let's move on to something else, or let's just go this way for now and revisit it later. So yes, these, you know, you do have arguments, but usually, you know, we are pretty much on the same page once we have convinced once we have kind of communicated what we are worried about to the other person.
Now, over the years, we've seen such tremendous growth in the internet. How does this change what you do?
So when the systems you've been building, they're fairly practical systems, and practical in the sense that we will make trade-offs based on sort of reality and assumptions about different numbers. So, for example, I mentioned the file system work. We made a trade-off. We said we can live without the ability to store more than, say, 10 to 50 million files. And we will give away that ability to store lots and lots and lots of small files. And the benefit is that we can simplify the system design by taking all of the metadata for all of the files and storing it in one place. It made a huge reduction in complexity. And what it allowed us to do was it was on the order of 6 months from concept design to the point in time where GFS was being used in production. And that's a remarkably small amount of time for a file system. And the only reason we were able to do that was because we made these trade-offs. Now, of course, these trade-offs eventually become false, or many of them become false. So over time, we have had to replace GFS with a different file system, which can actually handle a larger number of files with a slightly different design. And yes, it, you know, we did have to replace it, but it was absolute. So, and that's the kind of thing that happens all the time. You build systems for one scale. Few years down the road, the scale has changed by a factor of 10 or 20. And at that point, you start having to think again about, well, let's step back and see whether or not we should redesign, re-implement, or if we can extend the lifetime of the current system.
Now, you talked about this updated file system. Can you talk about some of the design concepts behind this updated file system?
So this updated file system was not my work. I was busy working on some other systems by then. But I can the design was, in some sense, fairly similar to GFS's design. There was a central machine in GFS which stored all of the metadata, and then there was a whole bunch of machines we call chunk servers. Think of them as block servers, which would sort of serve the blocks of the data, the blocks of each file. So the metadata was managed in GFS centrally, and the blocks are spread across thousands of machines. So in the successor, which is called Colossus, what we did is we kept the overall structure the same. The metadata was separated from block storage. Block storage was spread across many machines. But what we did is we took the metadata, and instead of storing it on one machine, we store it in Bigtable. And Bigtable, as I had mentioned earlier, itself deals with spreading what it is storing into across many machines. So now the metadata for Colossus, the new file system, is also spread across many machines, and therefore now you can scale the system up so that it can handle hundreds of millions of files easily.
And then what's the next iteration after that?
The next iteration? Well, the Colossus has been doing very well for us, so right now we aren't thinking of anything, a drastic change to that. Though I suspect that in a few years down the road, we will probably be thinking about something. So one possible thing that we might end up having to do, that this isn't really close to anybody's priority at the moment, is perhaps making it work, making a file system that works better across a wide area network. Both Colossus and GFS have the property that they run within a tightly coupled cluster of computers. So think of all the computers in one building as opposed to, say, spread across the world. And it's likely that if you wanted to have a file system that spans geographic areas like that, then you have to rethink and re-implement some things because communication becomes a lot slower.
Now, let's kind of expand out in terms of the work you've done. Now, how does the work extend to other domains?
So just a clarifying question, what particularly do you mean by domains? You mean domains other than search?
Yes, domains other than search, and perhaps even other fields of endeavor beyond computing.
That's a great question. So I think we have been pretty careful to make sure that it is the most of the systems you're building are not search specific, and that has been pretty valuable to us. So for example, if you look at MapReduce, right, in its definition and implementation, it really has nothing to do with search itself. It just says, give me input which can be partitioned into pieces, give me a map function, give me a reduce function, and MapReduce will take these three things together and do the computation on lots of machines and produce the output. And nowhere in that specification was there anything specific to search. And this is the thing that we had to be a little bit careful about when we kind of were designing it, to make sure that we took enough of a step back away from the search-specific problems that we were trying to solve to come up with something which could extend to other places. And it has been very helpful for us to have done that, right? MapReduce is used by, you know, pretty much all of the programmers at Google, regardless of whether they're working on search or if they're working on some other things like advertising or applications or machine learning. So it definitely extends outside search. And I think, as you can see, some of the open source equivalents of these systems like Hadoop are also being used in many, many varieties, many, many domains, as you mentioned. Similarly, Bigtable is, you know, I think I mentioned that it was started off by, it was motivated by storing search-related data, but now it's basically used as the storage system for the vast majority of the applications built inside Google, and many of them are not search.
So then what are the practical applications and implications of your work influencing our daily lives, the greater audience that's out there?
So this is a hard question to ask somebody who works on infrastructure systems like Jeff and I do. Most of the systems we build are never directly exposed to end users, right? I cannot go to my parents and point them, so yeah, this part of the web page is the part that I built. Our stuff is sort of sitting farther behind those front-end systems. But there are some impacts I think we can point to. So for example, when Gmail was initially launched many, many years ago, and it guaranteed a gigabyte of storage per user, it was launched and it was announced on April 1st, and most people thought this was a joke, April Fool's joke, because people couldn't believe that we would be able to afford giving a gigabyte of storage to each user. However, you know, it was a real product, and it was made possible because we had infrastructure systems like GFS, which would allow us to manage a large number of disks efficiently, and therefore we could take sort of the lowering disk prices and just sort of allow end users to take benefit of, to sort of take advantage of that by giving them these larger storage quotas. And this was made possible only because we had kind of worked hard on the infrastructure to manage this large amount of data efficiently.
Sanjay, you have quite an extensive history in many other areas other than what we've talked about before. So can you additionally profile your extensive research history, their lasting impact, and some valuable lessons you wish to share from each of your top research areas?
Sure. Let's see. Let me just pick a couple of examples. So one example is a bunch of us, including Jeff, when we were in the late 90s, we were working at Digital Equipment Corporation's research labs. So we worked on a performance profiling system for a low overhead performance profiling system for alphas. So what the system would do is you would just leave it running all the time on your machines, and it would just sort of in the background at very low overhead collect fine-grained performance properties of your programs, and you could go look at them and figure out where the bottlenecks were and so forth. And working on this system, it was the first time I'd worked on a profiling system, and I learned a lot from my colleagues. And one of the things I learned was the value of having a system like this. A system which you can kind of, is cheap enough that you can kind of run it in production on real programs. It pays for itself, even if it, like, for example, slows down your programs by, say, a percent or two. It pays for itself very quickly because the insight you get into how things are executing allows you to make much bigger improvements in your performance. So if you're working on a system and you cannot find a low overhead profiling system, go look for one, and if you can't even find one, then, you know, build one for your system. It'll be worth it. And some other things, one of the things that I think around the time that I was working on GFS, we were noticing that we were having memory problems in our implementation. In particular, what was happening is that the malloc library we were using was leading to a lot of fragmented memory, memory which was wasted because it was just chopped up into small enough pieces that it couldn't be used for any of the incoming requests for memory that we had. And so we tried to tune the existing malloc implementation we were using for a while. But eventually what we had to do is we had to kind of give up and write a new malloc implementation from scratch. And this was, you know, it kind of goes against something people often say, which is, you know, don't reinvent the wheel. But sometimes, you know, if you're having problems with your wheels, you kind of have to step back and think about, you know, well, how do I fix the problems? And sometimes, you know, reinventing the wheel is the right thing to do.
What are your current research interests?
So it is a bit hard to characterize them right now. The main thing that I'm focused on is trying to figure out how to, so if you look at Google, all of the services that Google provides, sort of behind them, there are a whole bunch of other internal services and the end user facing surfaces are composed or out of all of these lower level services, thousands of them. And these services have evolved organically. They've gotten added. They're hard to remove once they've been added because, you know, other services start depending on them. So things have become very complicated, and they have sort of ad hoc rules for how the services communicate with each other, how they do various common things like logging and all kinds of other stuff. So I'm trying to figure out what is a good way to simplify the deployment of such large collection of interrelated services. And there isn't really anything concrete there yet. It's more sort of in problem examination phase, trying out various ideas. So that's sort of one of the things that keeps me busy. And some of the other stuff is Jeff and I are trying to work on. They were playing around with some compression schemes for some domain-specific data that we have. But again, it is sort of preliminary work. There isn't much more to say at the moment about it.
Can you extrapolate then maybe some of the broader applications and implications of your work?
So I presume you mean the current work that I just described?
Yes, that's right.
So the hope is that if we take the deployment, suppose we were able to take the management and deployment of these services that I mentioned. Suppose you make it very simple. So the person or team deploying the service just writes down a very simple description of what they want to do, what they want the service to be, which program implements the service, where it should run, how it should react to changes in load, etc. Then what we can do is we can automate the management of all of this and make the people who are deploying services, their lives much easier. And so those people can just focus on whatever, on sort of the heart of the service they want, as opposed to all of the sort of the service management headaches that they have to deal with personally right now. And that'll make them more productive, and hopefully they'll come up with better, more ambitious services because they'll be free from having to deal with the management complexity for these things. So it's very pragmatic. We're running into complexity and management issues, and we're just trying to figure out some simple way of, you know, removing the burden of this management from people.
The next question has two parts, and that is, I want to sort of drill into your future research interests. Now, this is as part of this Google team in terms of what your future research interests are, but also, if you were just independently able to go in any direction, what would be your future research interests?
It's a tough question for me to answer because I've always had a tough time kind of formulating and working on problems in the abstract. I'm much better if I can look at problems that either I'm encountering or people around me are encountering, and then sort of take a step back from that and have the research fall out of the real problems that we are running into. And the reason I like to work this way is it makes it very easy to make sure that you're working on things that matter because you can see that they matter. Now, the downside of this is that you can be, and this is, and the downside of operating this way is that you might not think far enough out, right? If you're focused on today's problems, you will not solve tomorrow's problems unless you get lucky. So I don't have a great answer here, but it is not one of my strengths is to sort of, think very far ahead on research interests. And I think part of the impact that our work has had is because it's been sort of a bit more focused on having impact on the problems you're running into.
You know, there's reports about this thing called a knowledge graph, a database of hundreds of millions of real-world objects, or, you know, there's Google Now, where you can get sort of little pieces of useful information before you need them or before you think you need them. There's this Google's user research lab trying to figure out what kinds of information people want, or that, you know, on any given day, only 16% of the questions that people ask Google are totally new. So a lot of queries are Google has never seen before. And then I see these different kinds of, interviews with Google researchers where they talk about, you know, maybe we can have a kind of a Star Trek-like computer. And is Google able to kind of figure that out? You know, something that will come up with correct answers to questions that's never come across, that maybe can anticipate sort of the thinking of the user. And I know one of your researchers talked about this sort of toothbrush test, you know, of you using something twice a day or, and it'll happen within the next few years where you'll use it because it's just always able to give you, you know, very relevant information that will help you in your day-to-day work and perhaps significantly change our lives so much that in 5 years you'll think, how did I even get, you know, live without it? And maybe Google Glass is a early manifestation of what this could look like in the future. Do you have any thinking about some of these ideas, which are not directly related to your research, but, you know, just sort of bigger ideas?
So I am not, you mentioned a whole bunch of very interesting stuff that is going on at Google and I think at other places too. And I'm not personally working on any of them at the moment. But I'm really, really excited about sort of what people are working on. And I think the Star Trek computer vision, you know, that you mentioned, vision of having something like a Star Trek computer, it's been around, you know, that idea has been floated around Google for, you know, a decade or more. People have said, you know, right now search is in its infancy and we have lots and lots of things to before we get to something like, say, a Star Trek computer. And I think people are making steps in that direction. Like, that's the kind of thing where you can't really just take one giant leap and end up there. You have to there's a whole bunch of problems that people are working on. You mentioned the knowledge graph and using that and Google Now, and there's machine learning stuff going on. So I think that there is going to be, we're starting to see some concrete results. Phones are starting to have much better voice recognition. Like, it's getting to the point where it is, you know, I will often just speak into a phone instead of typing in a query and so forth. So promising things are happening. And I suspect that 5 years down the road, we'll be in just a very, very different place than we are today, especially when it comes to interactions with computers and how much they understand of what we are asking them.
Now, what are your most difficult challenges in research and what valuable lessons do you wish to share?
So one of the challenges, especially at a place like Google with so many people working on so many different things, is just complexity. And complexity is something which just creeps in a little bit at a time. So suppose you have a system and somebody is using it in a new way and they need a fairly simple, small, innocuous feature to be added to the system. So you add that. And then you add it, you do this over and over again. And, you know, a few years down the road, you have something which is just filled with these small, innocuous features, but now the whole system as a whole is just very, very hard to understand and use and change and improve. So you kind of have to manage this complexity very, very carefully. Now, you can't really just go and say no to everything, right? Because that's too extreme. You might be avoiding adding something which is very, very useful to lots of people. So that is a hard challenge, is finding that dividing line. Is if there is something that you think might be worth adding, say a feature or an extension to a system, should you do it or not? And I don't have a great answer. One of the things I try to look for is to say, is this something which will allow more than just the person who immediately needs this feature to benefit from the new feature? Like, for example, when we were designing Bigtable, we were having arguments about whether or not we should build a compression system directly into Bigtable, or should we just ask the user storing data to compress the data before they store it into Bigtable. And you could see that tension between complexity and convenience there. And we ended up saying, okay, let's just build it in, and it ended up being a big win because it was very useful across for lots and lots of applications who are storing data into Bigtable. So that's one challenge, is managing complexity. Some other challenges are things, it's really good to be able to think of designs for systems, just work them out on pencil and paper and sort of toss out a whole bunch of designs and see which ones will work out. And one of the tricks that I first saw being used and picked up when I was in grad school was, if you're going to build something, instead of building it first, just figure out what expensive operations it'll have. And, you know, an expensive operation might be something like, how many disk seeks does it do for every incoming query? And then you just multiply the number of those expensive operations by the cost of those operations, like each disk seek is, say, 10 milliseconds. And if you can get kind of good at doing this, and some of this is psychological, you kind of have to be confident about making guesses, sort of well-informed guesses about these things. If you get good at doing this, you can go through a whole bunch of designs very quickly. Instead of implementing them, you just sort of feed them through this back-of-the-envelope calculation, and very often you can rule out a whole bunch of things immediately. And so then you can focus your, you know, sort of on the design and implementation of what's remaining and try to get a good answer for that.
I see. So in essence, sort of having a minimal viable concept prior to doing a lot of investment in time or actually in cost.
Yes, it is similar to that. It is a bit more focused than that. So, for example, suppose you were deciding that you wanted to write a sorting algorithm, right? I mean, this is just a made-up example. Most people will not do this. And the sorting algorithm is going to sort data which does not fit in memory. So you want to have an on-disk sorting algorithm. And you didn't have access to literature which lets you know which one you should use, so you were trying to decide between a couple of different ways of doing it. So now the expensive operations that you will have are going to be streaming data to the disk. If you're reading and writing to disk in random order, then it'll be the disk seeks for those random, the disk seek costs for those random operations. So you can pretty quickly, if you have an algorithm in mind, you can pretty quickly just estimate that for a particular data size, how many expensive disk operations you will do. And you multiply those, you know, constants, numbers for disk seek performance into those estimates, and you can immediately decide, oh, okay, merge sort is better than doing something which looks like, say, quick sort in this case. And you can just sort of focus on that implementation. And this is very useful early on when you're actually coming up with the design of a system, because you kind of have a wide open space in front of you and you have to narrow it down to something practical that you can explore further.
Now, are there areas of controversy that you would suggest in the areas that you research?
So, there's always healthy discussions and arguments about various things. One of the things, for example, is, we are moving into a multi-core world. Most processors people have, even on phones, you know, they have 2, 4, 8 processors, and most phones have 2, 4, 8 processors on them. And there's a lot of, it's up in the air as to what is the best programming model for multi-core. There are sort of very, very many passionate arguments about this, across the research community. You know, it's often divided across programming language boundaries. Some people want, say, functional programming is the answer. Other people are, you know, suggesting things like CSP-style programs, which, you know, are, so for example, Erlang and Go have that style of programming. Other people are happy to live with lock-based multi-threaded programming. And of course, that is, the argument against that is that leads to too much complexity. It is unclear to me which one of these very, very different ways of doing parallel computation will win out. And there's definitely a lot of controversy here.
And this is, again, a forward-looking question, so I know it's going to be difficult. But can you describe the types of research being created or updated that will drive our experiences in, let's say, 5 years and or maybe even 10 years and what this experience will be like? And if you could paint a picture for our audience.
I think you did a really good job of answering this question just a few minutes ago when you started describing, you know, the vision of the Star Trek computer. So I think that's one of the things that'll happen at the user interaction side is, and you can see bits of it already, search is becoming a bit smarter about the types of things that allows it does for you. Voice recognition is getting better. I suspect that what will happen is that these things will evolve probably at a higher rate that they've been doing for the last 10 years. And, you know, 5, 10 years down the road, I suspect that most people will, for example, will not be interacting with computers using keyboards. Obviously, some people will do. Programmers, text entry, you know, writing text, it might be hard to beat keyboards for a while because people can type faster than they can speak, well, most people. Most people who know how to type can do that. So it's not clear that voice will take over everything, but I suspect that casual interactions will change quite a bit. There's going to be probably some more deeper changes in systems, you know, maybe not visible to end users. Clock rates on our processors have been stagnant for 10 years. We've been kind of squeezing Moore's Law is still going, you know, we're squeezing more and more transistors into chips. But people who know better about this tell me that perhaps that's not going to continue much longer either. And so that's going to have to cause us to make changes, significant changes in how we build system. We've been kind of riding the Moore's Law curve and sort of what the hardware people have been gifting to us software people for so many decades, that once those gifts stop coming, we'll have to adjust and start being better at the software level about how to deal with a world where sort of power management is a bigger deal than it has been ever before. You have to be a lot more efficient about how you use power, computing resources, etc., and how you take advantage of sort of the much wider parallelism that's sort of available on your chips.
I mean, we're going to go back into your past, and this question is about maybe some specific challenges in your education at Cornell and MIT that were catalysts or inflection points in your lifetime and contributions, and how and why did this happen?
So I think the thing that I remember most from Cornell was I was taking a distributed systems class, and I really enjoyed sort of the thinking and the papers that we were reading in there, and that is sort of what got me interested in distributed systems first, is just reading those papers, and I got really excited. And so when I was applying for grad school, I was looking for research groups in that area, and I was lucky enough to end up in Professor Barbara Liskov's group at MIT, and I found that was a remarkably, you know, I really didn't, you know, obsess over the decision too much. I kind of just went and talked to her, and I was, you know, happy when I chatted. I liked the work, the papers I was reading from her group, so I decided to join the group, and that was a great decision in hindsight. I learned a lot from her. The colleagues that I found there were they were just great. We worked on lots of interesting systems there. So I find myself fortunate that I kind of somehow lucked out into going into the right places where I could develop the skills that I needed and sort of the people I had a chance to work with.
Sanjay, I want to apply the same question now in terms of the specific challenges in your work that were catalysts to inflection points in your lifetime and contributions, and how and why did this happen?
So I think I've touched a little bit on this already. The catalysts were, one of the catalysts, especially for the different projects that Jeff and I worked on, were sort of the hard problems you're running into. So let me mention GFS. I think just before we started designing GFS, we were helping to manage the sort of web search crawling and indexing system. And this was remarkably painful, because what would happen is it was a never-ending task. You know, you would start the next crawl index cycle to pick up new web pages that had shown up. And, you know, you would start running a whole bunch of computation and managing the data for that. And every so often a machine would break, and you would have to go detect that machine broke and start off some scripts to copy data around. And this got very, very frustrating. And I'd always had in the back of my mind that at some point I would like to, you know, build a file system again. And this sort of, these two things kind of collided and says, hey, here's a place where a file system would really, really help. And here's a sort of, the problem is restricted enough. We just need to deal with a reasonably small number of large files that we can build a fairly simple file system very quickly. And that is kind of what was, led us to GFS. And sort of, there's a similar story behind MapReduce, which was, you know, as I mentioned already, we were working on stuff and it looked very similar to, you know, programs we had written before, and we were kind of tired of writing the same thing over and over again. So the catalysts were sort of the pain that we were dealing with.
Sanjay, you know, you've got this amazing history of remarkable contributions, and you've laid many of the foundational pillars through your pioneering work. Now, distilling from your experiences, what are the greater burning challenges and research problems for today's youth to solve, to inspire them to get into computing?
That's a great question. I don't know what the right thing to do is. There's a tension here, right? You might say that it is that we should highlight the great research problems in computer science, and that might draw people, draw young people to be interested in computer science. But I wonder if it would be better there's an alternative path, right? Which is, you could just show people that, you know, computer science is, you know, software programming at least, is about sort of building things, you know. So if you could kind of get people involved in building things and show them how much fun it is, and I can see that around me. I know some colleagues, children and stuff, who are involved in robotic competitions where they are just amazingly engaged and excited about what they're building. So it's a bit probably more direct way to entice people to be interested in computer science. The research, I think, will come later as sort of people get more experience with building systems, figuring out the problems that are happening, get more exposure to math, decide if they want to go in research or if they want to just build products directly. It is hard to predict ahead of time which person will want to end up in research as opposed to building products. Certainly, when I first started grad school, I thought I wanted to be a researcher. When I entered Google, I thought I did not want to do any more research. I just wanted to build products. But since then, I have ended up, you know, being involved in research as well. So it varies. And I think just sort of, I really love building things. And I think communicating that pleasure to young people might be a good way to get them to sort of be interested in computing.
Can you name three or more people who inspire you, and why is this so?
So the first person I'd like to mention is sort of going pretty far back when I was growing up in India. It was my uncle. He would always, you know, we would go in sort of these road trips, etc., with me and my cousins and some other people, and he would always keep us engaged during these drives. But you know, he would just make up math problems, sort of set in some real world situation. He would just ask us questions around that, and you know, he encouraged me to, in my sort of what I mentioned, you know, sort of learning to build things and stuff like that. He gave me a little kit where sort of electrical parts where I could sort of build various circuits and things like that, and gave me access to lots and lots of reading materials. So he got me started on this path where I was interested in engineering and science, and I'm very grateful for that. The other person is Professor Liskov, who was my advisor when I was in grad school, and I learned a lot both directly from her and being part of her group. The thing I learned most from and respect most about her is her sort of ability to kind of design, have simple design and descriptions of distributed systems. I've seen sort of equivalent attempts to describe systems which correspond in some ways, and they are much more complicated than what she did, than the way she would describe them. So I really understood the benefit of simplicity and sort of clarity of design and presentation from her. And then the third person I would like to mention is Jeff Dean, who's the co-winner of this award. And we have had an amazingly productive relationship for the last 15-16 years. Since before we joined Google, we worked at the same lab. We've been working closely together. He has amazing breadth in his interests. He's always very motivated and fun to work with, and he has this relentless focus on getting things done and performance of systems that he's building. And I have gotten a lot of, I've benefited a lot from my work with him.
We're getting to the end of this interview, so I've got some very general questions. This next one is about, and you can choose the topic area, and it could be in any domain, but what do you see as the top challenges facing us today?
So what do you mean by us? Do you mean the computing community, something wider, something narrower?
Yes, you can define it any way you wish. So it could be within the computing community, it could be political, it could be geopolitical, it could be economic. There is no restriction.
I was I don't spend too much time thinking about it. The one thing does, a couple of things resonate with me based on sort of people I've been talking to, talks I've been, you know, listened to recently is, I think we can probably have a huge impact on the world if we can figure out how to make computing more accessible to more people. And this is not a challenge of computing. It's a challenge for, it's more about infrastructure and availability and so forth. I suspect that there are many, many people in this world who have no access to computing who would get amazing benefits if they did have that access. They would be able to learn more about sort of maybe the crops they're planting. They might be able to learn about the health problems they're facing. So I suspect that that's sort of one big but achievable challenge that that might have a huge impact on the world. There's, I think, another interesting challenge that's coming up is in the field of biology. I think we are getting better at collecting data. For example, I think the genetic sequencing field is just taking off. And there are many, many diseases which could be perhaps cured or have much better treatments if you could kind of apply computing power, which is getting cheap enough to be effective on, say, at the scale of an entire genome. So I suspect that there is going to be, in the next 10 years or so, there's huge opportunities in the combination of computing and biology in terms of improving our health.
Now, Sanjay, just one last question, and very quickly, do you have any sort of lessons you want to share with the audience, because you've had such a long and distinguished career?
So I just have one important lesson. Well, at least it was important for me. I never really worried too much about, I didn't obsess over decisions about which college to go to, which, whether or not I should join Google or some other startup. The main thing I did was said, where are the people that I want to work with? And that has been very, very helpful to me. Find something you like to do, find people you know you'll like working with them, and then work with them. It's a big source of happiness, and it probably has led to some of my productivity as well.
Sanjay, you have an amazing body of work, and it's being recognized through this award and through many of the other accomplishments that you've had over your career and will continue to have throughout your life. So I know your schedule's demanding, and we are indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. And thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here and answer your questions. Thanks.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Sanjay Gamawat, ACM Infosys Foundation Award recipient in 2013, which is computing's top prize for young innovators. Sanjay is also a world-renowned researcher.